Eyes.
Of course I wanted to know your eyes.
WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
You're listening to Transmission Arts programming on WGXC.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Philip Grant of Nassau, New York.
Hey, man.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers, friends, and enemies. And I'm listening to you, me, your host, Norman Douglas, and the show is Midnight Smoke. Nothing you hear on this show tonight is true. First story is from a 2018 collection of stories by a person named N.K. Jemison. It's called Red Dirt Witch. Oh, it's in the book How Long Till Black Future Month. That came out 2018. And the story is Red Dirt Witch. The way to tell the difference between dreams that were prophecy and dreams that were just wasted sleep was to wait and see if they came three times. Emelina had her third dream about the white lady on the coldest night ever recorded in Alabama history. This was actually very cold, 10 degrees below zero on a long, dark January Sabbath when even the moon hid behind the veil of shadow. Emmeline survived the cold the way poor people everywhere have done since the dawn of time, with a warm, energetic friend. Three patchwork quilts helped too. The friend was Frank Heath, who was pretty damn spry for a man of 55, though he claimed to be 45, so maybe that helped. The quilts were M's, and it also helped that one of them had dried flowers, jacking the pulpits and a few nuggets of charcoal tucked under each patch of leftover cloth. That made for a standing invitation to warmth in the summertime, who were, of course, welcome to pay a visit and stay the night any time they liked. Those had come calling to the children's beds, at least, for which Emmeline was grateful. The children slept soundly, snug, comfortable. That left Em and Frank free to conduct their own warmth making within the conscience. Excuse me, after that was done, Emmeline closed her eyes and found herself in the commissary market down on Dugan. Dusty southern daylight, bright and fierce even in winter, shone slanting onto the street alongside the market, unimpeded by cars or carts or people. Pratt City wasn't much of a city, being really just a Negro neighborhood of Birmingham, but it was a whole place, thriving and bustling in its way. Here, though, Emmeline had never seen the place so empty in her life. As if despite the cold, the market's bins tumbled over with summer produce, watermelons and green tomatoes and peaches and more, along with a few early collards. That meant that whatever this dream meant to warn her of, it would come with the heat of the mid-month. Out of habit, Em glanced at the sign above these last. Overpriced again, greedy bastards. Why, greed's a sin, said a soft, whispery voice all around her. Be proper, you'd punish him for it, wouldn't it? This was one of the spirits that she'd tamed over the years. They liked to test her, though, so it was always wise to be careful with it. Supposing I could, she said in reply, but only the store manages, since the company too big to go out. And I can't say that I truly blame the manager either, since he got chum the fee the same as me. Then sin, woman. And let she who is without sin cast the first stone, and countered easily, as you well know. Then she checked herself. No sense getting testy, ill-wishing open doors for ill winds to blow through, which was probably why the voice was trying to get her to do it. The voice sighed a little in exasperation. It was colorless, genderless, barely a voice at all. That sigh whispered like wind through the stand of pines across the street. Just telling you somebody coming, cranky old biddy. Who, Jesus Christ, about time and slow ass. Whispery laughter. Finally, there's a white lady coming. Fine one. And she got something special in mind for you and yours. You ready? Em frowned to herself. The other two dreams had been more airy-fairy than this. Just collections of symbols and hints of the threat, omens and portents. It seemed fate had finally gotten impatient enough to just say plain what she needed to hear. No, I ain't ready, Em said with a sigh. But ain't like that ever made no mind of some folk. Thank you for the warning. More laughter rising to become a gale, picking Emmeline up and spinning her about. The market blurred into a whirlwind, but through it all there were little ribbons that she could see edging into the tornado from elsewhere, whipping about in shining silken red. Truth was always there for the taking if you only reached out to grasp it. Thing was, Em didn't feel like grasping it. She was tired. Lord have mercy, she was tired. The world didn't change. If she just relaxed, the dream would let her back into sleep like she wanted, but, well, best to be prepared, she supposed. So Em stretched out a hand and laid hold of one of the ribbons. Suddenly the street that ran through the market was full of people, angry people, most of them white, lining the road and marshing people, most of them black and in the middle of the road. The black ones' jaws were set, their chins high in a way that always meant trouble when white folks were around because, Lord, didn't they hate seeing pride. Trouble, trouble, sang the song of the voice, and before the marchers appeared a line of policemen with billy clubs in their hands and barking dogs at their sides. Emmeline's guts clenched for the blood that would almost surely be spilled. Pride. What was all that blood? Yet when she opened her mouth to shout at the marchers for their foolishness, the whispery voice laughed again, and she spun again, the laughter chasing her out of dream and up to reality. Well, this was what she wanted, but she didn't much like it because reality was dark and painfully cold on her mouth and chin when she stuck outside the covers to breathe. Her teeth were chattering. She reached back. "Ain't time to get up," muttered Frank at her stirring, half-dreaming himself. "You got Sunday to rest," said Emily. "You wait, you want to live till then, you get to work." His low, rich laugh warmed her more than his body ever could. "Yes, ma'am," he said, and did as he was bid. And because they had set to, Emily missed that her only girl child, Pauline, got up and walked the hall for a while, disturbed by bad dreams of her own. Since the spirits had given her a full season's warning, Emma spent the time preparing for the White Lady's arrival. This meant she finished up as much business as possible in the days right after the dream. The cold passed quickly, as cold was wont to do in Alabama, and as soon as the weather was comfortable again, Emmeline set Pauline to grinding all the herbs she'd laid in since November, then had her boy, Sample, put her shingle out by the mail post where read herbs and prayers, all and sundry. This brought an immediate and eager stream of customers. First there was Mr. Jake, who'd gotten into a spat with his cousin over Christmas dinner and had wished death on him, and now was regretting it because the cousin had come down with a wet cough. Emily told him to take the man some chitlins made with sardine oil and extra garlic. Then she handed him a long braid of garlic beads, 10 in all, from her own garden. "That much garlic?" Jake had given her a look of pure affront. Like most men of Pratt City, he was proud of his cooking. "I look Italian to you? All right, let him die then." This elicited a giggle from Pauline, who sat in on most of Em's appointments these days. So, grumbling, Jake had bought the garlic from Emmeline and gone off to make his amends. People talked about Jake's stanky, awful chitlins till the day he died, but his cousin ate some of the peace offering and got better. There was Em's cousin Rince, who came by just to chat and conveniently told Emmeline all the goings on in and around Pratt City. There was trouble brewing, Renee said. Political trouble. Whispers in the church pews, meetings at the school gym, plans for a boycott or two or ten. Way up in Virginia, folks were suing the government about segregation in the schools. Em figured it wouldn't come to nothing, but all the white folks was up like angry bees over the notion of their precious children sitting next to Negro children, competing against Negro children, befriending Negro children. It was going to get ugly. Many evils came riding in on the tails of strife, though, so here Emmeline suspected would be their battleground. Then there was Nadine Yates, a widow, who, like Emmeline, had done what she had to do to keep herself and her children alive through the cold and not-so-cold days. Nadine was afraid she might be pregnant again. "I know it's a sin," she said in her quiet, dignified voice while Emmeline fixed her some tea. For this one, she sent Pauline off to market with her brothers. Pauline was still just a girl, and some things were for grown women's ears only. "Still, if you could help me out, I'd be grateful." Sin's making a world where women got to choose between two children eating and three children starving, Emmeline said, and you sure as hell didn't do that. You made sure he wasn't some fool who spread it all over, didn't you? "You got a wife and a good job, and you ain't stupid. Gave my boys new coats just last week." A man who knew how to keep a woman on the side properly. But then, wouldn't it be simple enough for him to just take care of the new child, too? Emmeline frowned as a suspicion entered her mind. "He white?" Nadine's jaw flexed a little, and then she lifted her chin in fragile defensiveness. He is. Emmeline sighed, but then nodded toward the tea cooling in Nadine's hand. Drink up now. Sound like he can afford a guinea hen to me. So, a few days later, after the tea had done its work, Nadine dropped by and handed Emmeline a nice, fat guinea fowl. It was a rooster, but Em didn't mind. She pot-roasted it with dried celery and a lot of rosemary from the garden and the rind of an orange that Pauline had found on the road behind a market truck. Emmeline had smacked the girl for that because even though finding wasn't stealing, white folks didn't care much for making decisions when it came to little brown girls. But Pauline, who was smart as a whip and Em's pride, had glared at her mother after the blow. Mama, I followed the truck to a stop sign and offered to give it back. I knew that white man wouldn't want it because I touched it, and he did. So there. Smart as a whip, but still just a child, and innocent yet of the world's worst ugliness. Emmeline could only sigh and thank God the truck driver hadn't been the kind who'd notice how pretty Pauline was becoming. As an apology for the smack, she let Pauline have half the orange while the boys got only a quarter apiece. Then she set the girl down for a long talk about how the world worked. So it was as the brief winter warmed toward briefer spring and began the long, slow march into southern summer. By the time the tomato plants flowered, Em was as ready as she could be. Oh, Miss Emmeline, called the voice from outside. An instant later, Jim and Sample, Emmeline's boys, ran into the kitchen. There's a red lady outside, Sample gushed. Well, go figure, Emmeline said. Ain't like you ain't a quarter red yourself. Her papa had been Black Creek. His hair run cut till death. Not that kind of red, said Sample, rolling his eyes enough to get a hard look from Emmeline. She asking for you. Is she now? Emma turned from the pantry and handed Sample a jar of peach preserves. Open that for me and you can have some. Delighted to be treated like a man, Sample promptly sat down and began wrestling with the tight lid. I don't like this one, said Jim, and since Jim her artist. None of the dreaming in him, but he saw things others didn't. Emmeline knew the time had come. She wiped her hands on a cloth and went out onto the porch to meet the white lady. She smelled the lady before she saw her, a thick waft of magnolia perfume too cloying to be quite natural. Outside, the perfume wasn't as bad, diminished and blended in among the stems of Em's garden and the faint sulfurous miasma that was omnipresent in Pratt City on still days like this, that from the village creek, polluted as it was with nearly a century's worth of iron and steel manufacturing waste. The woman to whom the perfume belonged stood on the grassy patch in front of Em's house, fastidiously away from the red dirt path that most people walked to reach her front porch. Why, this lady was just as pretty as a flower in a full-skirted dress of cotton print, yellow covered in white and green lilies. No crinoline, but nearly as old-fashioned, with layers separated by bunched taffeta and edged in lace. Around the heart-shaped bodice, her skin was white as pearl, so white that Em figured she'd have burned up in a minute if not for the enormous parasol pushed positioned over her head. Here was why Sample had called her red, the confection of her hair, spun into an elegant chignon behind her head and topped with a crown of white flowers that was nearly as burgundy as good wine. It was all Em could do not to feel inadequate given that she wore only an old faded house dress, with her own hair done up in plaits and hidden away beneath a wrap. But she drew herself up anyway and reminded herself that she needed no parasol to keep her skin fine. The sun did that itself, and black didn't crack beneath its blessing. Those were just surface things anyway. The white lady was nearly all surface. That was the nature of her kind. That was how this meeting would go then, an appearance of grace and gentility covering the substance of battle. "I have come to see about you, Miss Emily," the white lady said, as if they were in the middle of a conversation and not the beginning. Her voice was light and sweet, as honey, as her yellow eyes. "You know me?" "Well, yes, ma'am," Em said, because she knew the children were watching and it wouldn't do for them, especially the boys, to think they could smart off the white ladies, even if this one wasn't really a white lady. "Heard here and there you was coming." "Oh, did you now?" she simpered, dimples flashing, and flicked at her skirts. As she did this, Em caught a glimpse of a figure behind her, a little black girl, couldn't have been more than 7, crouched and holding the pole of the great big parasol over the woman's head. The little girl's feet were bare beneath the simple white shift she wore, and her eyes were still and empty. "I suppose I shouldn't be surprised that you heard," the white lady said, unfolding a little lace fan and fluttering it at herself. "Figured you'd have your ways. Could I trouble you for some tea or lemonade, though, Miss Emmeline? It's always almighty hot in this land. Not that that bothers your kind like it does mine." "Mighty hot indeed," Emmeline agreed evenly. She nodded to Pauline, who stood beside her, trembling a little. Even a half-trained girl child knew power when she saw it. Pauline jumped, but went inside. "This land made its natural people brown for a reason, old man, long before either yourn or most of mine came along. Seems to me you could make yourself fit the land better if you wanted, of course." The woman extended one long, thin arm and ran her fingers up her pearly skin, looking almost bemused to find such flesh upon herself. "I should, I suppose, but you know there's more reward than price comes with this skin." Em did indeed know. "Pauline's going to fetch some tea for you, ma'am. No lemonade, I'm afraid. Lemons cost too dear when you got 3 children and no husband, see?" "Ah, yes, about those children of yours." As much as Emmeline thought she had braced herself, she still couldn't help tensing up when the white lady's yellow eyes shifted to dance over the faces of Jim and Sample. Lord, but she should have guessed. America wasn't the old country. These days, the white folk didn't bother with silly tricks or living in mounds, and they didn't stay hidden. Why should they? One thing they still did in spades here in this land of cheap flesh was steal children. And if they kept the children of certain hue, why, the police didn't even ask. Emmeline set her jaw. The woman's eyes lingered on Jim, long enough to be worrying. Jim, smart one that he was, had gone still and quiet, looking down at his feet, knowing better than to meet any of the white woman's gaze. Sample was all a bristle, not liking the way the woman was eyeballing his little brother. Damnation, Emily never should have picked the Sample's father, a man who liked to fight. Boy was going to get himself in trouble someday. Em had a feeling, though, that this was a feint. Then Pauline came back onto the porch with a big, sweating glass of iced tea, and sure enough, the white lady's gaze landed on the girl with much more than greed for a cool drink. Pauline stopped there with her eyes narrowed because, like Emmeline, she knew what was beneath the surface. The woman laughed prettily at the look on the girl's face. "Trouble come and tell," the white lady sang, still grinning. "Trouble come and find, about to pay the price, but sweet blood like fine wine." She had a beautiful voice, lilting and him reverberant. Birds hardly sounded human, in fact, which was fitting enough. Em raised a hand in praise anyway, because beauty was meant to be acknowledged, and to deny it would just invite her further in. "Trouble always coming, ma'am," she replied to the song. "Some of us, this world made a trouble, not that you folk helped. Oh, Miss Emily, don't be like that. Come on here, girl, with that tea. It's powerful hot. Em glanced at Pauline. Pauline nodded once, tightly. Then she walked down the steps to the bottommost slab, no farther, and held forth the glass. The white lady sighed, throwing a look at Em.
Ought to raise your children to show some respect, Miss Emmeline.
Lots of ways to show respect, ma'am. White lady sniffed. Then she turned her head, and the little girl who'd been holding the parasol straightened and came round her. The parasol stayed where it was, holding itself up against the ground. As the child moved forward, Em's skin came all over goosebumps. Wasn't right. Seeing a child who should have been lively, so empty of life and magic. The little girl twitched a little while she walked, as if with a palsy, or as if jerked on the strings. She stopped before Pauline and held her hands up, and Em didn't blame Pauline at all for the grimace as she pushed the glass into the child's hands. Whose was she? Emily asked as the little girl twitched and moved to bring the tea back to her mistress.
Nobody who matters, Miss M, don't you mind?
The white lady took the glass of tea, then smoothed a hand over the child's soft cap of hair with an almost fond smile.
Such a lovely girl, though, isn't she? Everybody says you folk can be beautiful, but that's just not true. Where else would I be able to get this?
She preened, smoothing a hand over one unblemished, shining cheek.
She had power, Pauline said.
Em started. She was used to Pauline keeping her mouth shut around white folks like a good, sensible girl should. But Pauline was still staring at the little girl in horror. Her expression hardened, though, from shock into disgust.
She had power, and you took it like a damn thief.
The white lady's eyebrows looked to have climbed into her red hair for a moment. Emmeline was right there with her, shocked at Pauline's cheek. She snapped without thinking, Pauline, Elizabeth, shut your mouth before I shut it. Pauline shut up, though Emmeline could see the resentful flex of muscle around her jaw. But the white lady let out a soft laugh, chilling them both into silence.
Well, I can't say I think much of how you're raising your children, Miss Emmeline. Negro children never can sit still and be quiet, I suppose. Of course I took her power, girl. Not like she could do anything with it. Now I think I'm owed an apology, don't you?
Damnation. Stiffly, Emmeline said, I'm sorry for my daughter's foolishness, ma'am. I'll see to her when we are done talking.
Okay, but that isn't enough, Miss M.
The white lady tilted her head, long, red lashes catching the light.
Honestly, how's she going to learn respect if you do all the apologizing for her?
Pauline spoke tightly, with a darting glance at Emmeline for permission to speak.
I'm sorry too, ma'am. Now see, that wasn't so hard.
The white lady gestured with the tinkling glass of tea at Pauline, beaming.
But don't you think you owe me a bit more after smarting off like that? Why, I'm wounded. You called me a thief. And even if I am, it's the principle of the thing.
She stepped forward. I think you should come with me for a while and learn respect, don't you? No, ma'am, Emmeline snapped before Pauline could dig herself further into trouble. I don't think she owes you a thing beyond what you had.
Oh, now, be reasonable.
The white lady stepped forward once more, almost to the porch steps, but then she paused, her smile fading just a little. When she glanced off to the side, she spied the rosemary bush at last, growing scraggly in the summer heat. Growing though still, and by its growth weaving a bit of protection around the house. Beginning to frown, the woman glanced to the other side. There was plenty of sage, too, thriving in the heat. Unlike the rosemary. Eyes widening, the woman finally turned about, spying at last the prize of Emmeline's yard, the sycamore fig. It grew in an arc over on the far side of the yard, because because many years ago some neighborhood children had played on it and nearly broken its trunk. It had survived, though, through the heat, through the breaking, through isolation, for it was nearly the only one of its kind in America. By the stories Emmeline's own mother had told of its planting, the seed fig had been smuggled over from Africa herself, tucked into some poor soul's wound to keep it safe, living through the Middle Passage. "Supposed to be Rowan, Thorn, and Ash," said the white lady. All at once, she sounded sulky. Emmeline lifted her chin. "Bad word, too," she said, "'cause Lord knows I got some Scots-Irish in me from my poor slave mother's tribal travails. But this ain't the soil of iron. Red Alabama dirt roots, different protectors. And you ain't the same as your own back in the old country, neither. Not after all these years of drinking Negro blood. So rosemary, sage, and fig will do for you." White lady let out a huffy little sound, but then she took a dainty step back. She started to raise the glass of tea, then paused, focusing sharply on it. Her lip curled. Then she glared at Pauline. "Just a little bit of acorn flour, ma'am," Pauline said, with such exaggerated innocence in her voice that Emmeline had to stifle a smile in spite of herself. "For flavor. Rosemary, sage, and fig to bind," said the white lady. It was clear now that she was furious as she held the glass of tea out from herself and then dropped it. The tea spilled into the grass, and the glass split into three pieces. She drew in a deep breath, visibly mastering temper. "And oak to strike the blow. Well, Miss Emmeline, I'll grant you one this one, but it leaves us in a bit of a fix. You can't keep yours safe everywhere, and I can't be chasing after them all damn day and night." She thought a moment. "How about a deal?" "Ain't enough water in the River Jordan," Emmeline snapped. "Sure," the white lady's grin crept back, like a dog badly banished. "Safety and prosperity for the rest, if you give me but one." "I done told you no," Emmeline said. She was forgetting to pretend polite. Well, Sample hadn't gotten it only from his father. "How many more times I got to..." "What kind of safety?" asked Pauline. "Lord have mercy, I'm gonna have to kill this girl," Emmeline could not help muttering. But Pauline had set her jaw in that tight, stubborn way that meant she didn't care if she got a smack for it. She persisted, "How much prosperity?" And if that didn't spread the white lady's grin nearly from ear to ear, "Why, lot, sugar, bless your heart." "Girl, you shut your mouth," Emmeline snapped. But the white lady held up a hand, and all at once Emmeline found herself unable to speak. "Oh, mercy, M. Newsanna, stupid, stupid girl." "Pauline, don't," blurted Jim, but the white lady eyed him too. And he was shut up as firmly as Emmeline herself. Sample just stared from one to the other of his siblings, and from them to the white lady, his hands flexing as if he wanted to hit somebody but wasn't sure where to start. "Children should be seen and not heard," said the white lady, gesturing gratefully with her fan. "But ladies, with that blood like wine, sweet and high and so fine, get some choices in the matter till it's taken from them. What say you, Miss Pauline?" Pauline, to her credit, glanced at Emmeline again. Her belligerence had faded by now, and her small face was properly anxious and afraid. Then, though her jaw firmed and she faced the white lady squarely, "You said trouble was coming." "Oh, indeed," the white lady let her gaze drip left and right, syruping all over the boy. "So much trouble. Folks are getting uppity from here to the Carolinas. Desegregation. Non-discrimination. And don't you know them bullnecks will be hitting back fast, beating y'all back into your place." She stopped her gaze on hot-headed Sample. simple," said his jaw. "Hidden backhand, I tell you, on boys who think to be called men." Pauline caught her breath. Then, though, thank the Lord, she hit her bitter bottom lip. "I want to speak to my mother." There was a moment's long, pent-up pause. Then the white lady flipped her fan back up into a blurring wave, dropping into a mocking curtsy. The servant child moved jerkily back behind her, taking hold of the parasol again. "Seeking counsel is wise, and within the rules, besides," the white lady admitted. "Not too much counsel, though, little miss. Some deals don't last long." With that, she flounced off with the child in tow, though Emmeline noted that she skirted wide around the sycamore fig before passing behind a pine tree and vanishing. The instant Emmeline could speak and move, she did, hurrying over to Pauline and slapping the tar out of the girl before she could speak. "Didn't I tell you about folks like that?" she demanded, pointing with a shaking hand after the white lady. "Didn't I tell you they'll put a pretty orange in your hand and snatch it back with the hand attached?" It had been happening more and more lately that Pauline defied her. But then this was only proper, was it not? A girl coming into her womanhood and her adult power should speak her mind sometimes. "I know, Mama," Pauline said without a trace of apology. Her voice was so calm and strong, and even that Emmeline blinked. "But I had dreams." "Well, you should have told me. And you should have told me about the blood coming. I know how to make you safe for at least a bit of time, and you can't make me safe, Mama." Pauline said it so sharp, so hard, that Emmeline could only flinch back. "That's why you told me what to be scared of, ain't it? So I could make myself safe. And I know, because you taught me, that it's a woman's job to fight for hers." "That's a man's job," Jim said, scowling, though he too should have been quiet, cowed by the slap. Sample nodded fiercely. Emmeline groaned and put a hand in the air for strength. All of her children had forgotten how to mind, all at once. Decent folks' job," Dan Pauline said back with a little heat. "But Mama, I saw it in a dream. People marching. Big old redneck bulls standing up like men holding dogs and billy clubs. Blood everywhere." Emmeline's skin went all a prickle with remembered fear. Yet there was no fear in Pauline's face as she went on, her voice rising in excitement. "At the end of it, though, Mama, at the end I saw white children and black children sitting by each other in school. There was yellow and brown and red children there, too. Black people at the front of a bus, Mama." Pauline bit her lip, then leaned forward to whisper, but there was no one to hear but family. "I saw a black man in a big white house." There were always black men in big white houses of downtown Birmingham. Who else was going to tend their gardens or wash their cars? And yet there was fervor in Pauline's gaze that warned Emmeline of something more than a daughter's dream. Didn't matter though. The world didn't change. Somebody had to protect her fool children from themselves. Seething with pent-up anger and fear, Emmeline herded the children inside. She made them go to bed early with no supper, but smarting off because they had to learn, Pauline especially. Wasn't no prosperity worth a girl child's soul and what little innocence life allowed her? Wasn't no safety for black boys beyond what humility bought them, little as that was? And while they slept, Emmeline burned sage. She prayed to every ancestor of three continents who might listen. And then she set herself up a chair before the door with her grandmother's old musket across her knees. She'd stay up day and night if she had to, for her children's sake. After a few hours had passed in slow taut silence and the candles burned low and the weight of drowsiness pressed on the back of her head like a blanket, Emmeline got up to keep herself awake. She peeked in the boys' room. They were snoring, curled up, though Jim had a happy peach still on his hand, sneaked out from some hiding
Emmeline's room, though, was cold from the open window. Boston, a sharp, bitter wind. There would be only one place the girl could have gone, the fairgrounds, in the shadow of Red Mountain. Emmeline ran to Renee's house since Renee had the only moving phone on the street. There she called Frank, who came over bringing his mule. The mule ran like it knew what was at stake, so fast and hard that Emmeline's bottom was raw long before she reached the place. The fairgrounds were only fairgrounds once a year. Less of the pine was just a fallow field occasionally used for harvesting. Long ago, though, it had been the breaking ground of a plantation, a place where new slaves, freshly forced, marched up from the port of Mobile. Got branded in spirit, name, spirit, before being sent out into the fields. As Emmeline halted the mule and slid off its back, she felt all that old blood there in the ground, mixed with old tears and the red dirt beneath her feet. White folk fed on that sort of magic. This would be a place of power for them. As Em reached the top of the hill, she saw that Pauline stood beneath a pine, was being strangled by a carpet of kudzu. Before her stood the white lady, shining even more now, her skin catching the moon's gleam in the way of her people, ears gone to points and mouth too wide and full of sharp fangs. They both turned as Emmeline thumped up out of breath, her legs shaking from holding so right so tight to the mule's sides. Still she moved to stand between them in front of Polly, facing the white lady.
I ain't gonna let you.
Deal's done, Miss Emmeline, said the white lady, looking amused. Too late. Emmeline turned to Pauline, shaking, horrified. Pauline, though, lifted her chin. I saw it, Mama, she said. One life to three. Trouble coming whether we want it or not, but if I go, you and the boys will get through it. In a wordless fury, Emmeline flung herself at the white lady. She did this without using her body, and the white lady met her without hers, taking her up and out and through and into dreaming. Dream thing was, dreaming wasn't a thing mortal folks did so well when they are awake, so Emmeline tumbled, helpless, lashing out ineffectually. And in the perverse way of her kind, who loved to lie but liked it best of all when truth became their weapon, the white lady showed Emmeline the future that Pauline had bought. She saw markets full of melons and greens and peaches, all artificially fresh and reeking of chemicals in the dead of winter. Long elevated strips of road carving up Negro towns and neighborhoods all over the country. Gray looming schools isolating bright black minds and breaking their spirits and funneling them into jails. Police everywhere killing. Killing and killing. This, Emmeline fought nausea and despair, lest she strengthen her enemy. But it was nearly impossible not to feel something. Oh Lord, her baby had given up freedom for this. And yet, all at once Emmeline was not alone in her tumbling. Pauline, new and raw and woman strong, pushed at Emmeline, helping her straighten up. Then Pauline pointed, snatching more truth from the white lady's dream than even she wanted shown. The white lady hissed into their minds like ice on the griddle. Pauline ignored this and said, "Look, Mama." Then Em saw the rest. Marching black people attacked by dogs, but still marching. Children, sampled, struck by the blast of fire hoses, the torrent peeling off clothes and tearing skin. Still marching. Joined by dozens, hundreds of thousands, still marching. And before these marches, prayers and church plate dinners. Emmeline sprinkling a little fire into the chicken and dumplings to warm the marches against the cold hose water to come. Young women refusing to be ordered out of their bus seats to go sit in the back. Emmeline braiding a donkey's stubbornness into their hair. Children holding their heads high through crowds of shouting, jeering white teenagers and adults.
Emmeline trimming a few figs from the sycamore to make jam, sweetening the children's mouths with the taste of heritage and survival, and so much more. Brown faces in space. Emmeline could only stare at the stars and savor the impossible possibility. Brown men on the Supreme Court. Then she saw the Whitey House that Pauline had mentioned. The Whitey House, nestled amid statues and obelisks in the mirror pools of Washington, D.C., a place of power in itself. She saw a man standing on its steps, brown as fig jam. And then a woman, black as molasses, her gaze hard and high and proud. And then another woman, and another brown man, and so many more, their frequency increasing with the spinning of the dollar of the sun. Still marching, never stopping, till freedom was won. Pauline's single sacrifice could set all of it in motion. But no, Emmeline fought her way back toward wakefulness. I can't. It can't be me who stays. She didn't believe. She had taught her children to bow their heads, not lift them up high. I'm not what they need. You're gonna be all they got, sugar, said the white lady into the dream in a laughing whisper. No, she damn well would not be. The dream still spun around her. Emmeline set her jaw and plunged her hand into it, grabbing wildly this time, pulling back the jar of sycamore jam. Sin, she snapped. The top of the jar was tight, but she wrestled it off and plucked out a dripping soft sycamore fig to brandish against the churning dark. A deal's a deal, but one kind of prey the same as another to you lot, ain't it? You like children's beauty, but a woman's don't hurt you none. You like innocence, but you'll take foolishness, so here mine. Can't believe the world will ever change. I can't hope. It ain't in me. Spent too long making it easier for people to live downtrodden. I know how to survive, but I ain't got the fight for change in me. I like my babies do. So take me and leave her. No, Pauline shouted, but Emmeline had enough control to drown her out with the sound of chanting, marching cries. The shape of the white lady had blurred into the dream, but she was a sharp-toothed presence amid the squirrel. Take you both, child and fool, all mine. Emmeline grinned. Greed's a sin. The dream cracked a little beneath good Christian truth, allowing Em to summon the whip of burning sage. The white lady flinched hard enough to slow the whirlwind of the dream, for the smell carried with it lamentations for stolen land, stolen children, and the stolen lives of Em's Creek forebears. Emmeline set that in place opposite the jar of figs. Your bargain was 1 for 3, not 2 for 2. Images of marches warped and twisted around, the White House dissolving into the foxy face of the white lady. True enough, she said, conjuring up her fan again. Still, I'd rather the child, if you don't mind, or even if you do. Here, Emmeline faltered. She had not dreamt of Rosemary. Frantically, she rifled through images, tossing away the fish she dreamt of before each of her children, shoving aside the green tomatoes and the collards of the market. Lord, had she never once dreamed of bacon chicken? She had not. But then, through the tittering laughter of the white lady and her cronies, Emmeline smelled the dream of pot-roasted guinea rooster with orange peel and rosemary. That had been the first time Emmeline accorded her daughter with the respect of a fellow woman. And Pauline had been savoring that feeling all this time. There was a bit of innocence attached to it, too, lost after Emmeline's explanation about white men's oranges, the perfect sweetener to lure in a hungry fish. Indeed, the white lady paused, lifting her face a little and half closing her eyes in pleasure at the toothsome aroma. But then she stiffened as she caught the rosemary's perfume. Rosemary, sage, and fig, said Pauline in a tone of satisfaction. Now let my mama take me, Emmeline said, commanded now, because she could. She had bound the white lady by both the ancient rules of the old country and the newest rules of flesh and blood. The deal had been made. One innocent life for three lives, protected and prosperous. But Emmeline had control over which life the white folk got to keep. Mama, Pauline, her beautiful, powerful Pauline, abruptly resolved out of the dream swirl and turned to her. Mama, you can't. Hush, Emmeline went to her, held her close, kissed her corn-road head. I done told you a million times that the world done changed, but I was wrong. I'm sorry for that. You got a big fight ahead of you, but you can win it, and you're better suited for that fight than I'll ever be. She hugged the girl tight. Be strong, baby. Tell your brothers the same. I know y'all are his enemies. Pauline clutched at her. But Mama, you can't. I didn't want you. The white lady closed the dream around Emmeline, whisked her away. In the morning, Pauline woke up on the ground of the fairgrounds, wet with dew, weeping. Her brothers, who had come up to the fairgrounds to find her, came quietly to her side and held her tight. Cousin Renee took the children in, of course, for blood was blood. She sent them one by one to Alabama State for their learning. So they were there when the Freedom Rides began. Naturally, all three joined up. Through the dark times that followed, the foretold dogs and horses and beatings and unforeseen lynchings and assassinations and bombings, there were white folks aplenty doing evil. But no white folk. The fae did not go again where they had been bested once, and in any case, their time was waiting. The dirt of Alabama was red for many reasons, not the least of which it was full of iron ore. It took a lot of power to overcome that much iron, and the times were changing, such that not even black children could be stolen with impunity anymore. White folk kept their promise, at least. Jim got his arm bitten by a dog during a protest, but it did not tear his throat out. Hard-headed Sample dated a white woman and only had to flee town. The men who meant to chain him up behind their truck and drag him to death did not ever catch him. Pauline got married and dreamt of fish and made her own daughters to carry on the family legacy. After a few more years, she ran for city council and won. Nobody strung her up. Then she won for mayor and won that too. All the while she turned a tidy profit from the sideline barbecue business. Greens had a little extra warmth in them that made everyone feel better towards each other, so she called them Freedom Greens, mostly as a joke. One year, the black man Pauline had dreamt of in the White House passed through town. And he decided to come all the way to Pratt City to have some of Pauline's famous freedom. Folks went wild. Somebody paid her to write a book about her life. Somebody optioned the film rights. Companies called and asked to franchise the recipe, but Pauline said no. Instead, hiring a small staff, Pratt City dwellers, and leasing a commercial kitchen for all the thousands of orders for Greens herself. In every can, mind, there was a sprinkle of rosemary sage and a tiny dab of sycamore fig, just to cut the bitterness. Late one cold winter night, Pauline dreamt again of the white folk. She saw how lean and poly they were looking these days, deprived of easy prey, and as the hate of the world dwindled and left them hungry. But as she fought the urge to smile at their misfortune, for ill-wishing would only make them stronger, she caught a glimpse of a painfully familiar black face among their foxy ways, strong and proud and shining in its own way. A face that was smiling and satisfied, full of motherly pride. So the world changed. So Pauline woke up and called their eldest daughter, Chloe, whispering to her of secrets and savory things and yet to come, and of great granny, never to be forgotten. also be free. That's N.K. Jemisin from the book How Long Till Black Future Month, published 2018. The story is called Red Dirt. I think I read that story back in February, but it never actually made it to the air. And I finally gave it a read. I think on that particular show, I had read a story by Quentin Bixbaud that also never made it to the air. So I read a new one by him last. Okay, well, I'm listening to Good Night Norman. There's like 5 minutes left. I don't know what to do. I'll read something out of it. It's just a poem. I wrote kind of recently. It's called Drought. Drought. Oh, sweet summer shower, where are you now when I fret so? Long overdue for my naked ass to kiss a sky, dark as I feel my filth bills. Guilt clinging under gut. Brain and skin just for asking, doubting, judging you, untouched by wet tickles I'd gladly give, giggling fingernails to tippy toes, nipples, knee backs, neck nape and belly inclined in between much more, drenching away dramatic dribbling fears I fondle before I can trust that you're ever coming again. Your absence obvious every which way, I watch out for your cool caresses. Grass is browned, bees bewildered, trees leaving limbs aground, cricks coughing up cracked beds of hot rocks, willow choked up weeping, drowned world dervishes in dust bedeviled swimming holes, hot, lissome, yet still lonesome. Don't get me wrong, I ain't even able to tell you what you're doing. Not the way I run faucets, eat plastic bottles you fill, and welcome daylight so I can taste the sun and fossils squeezed by time. I don't know, I lack comparable metrics to unpack. At least I am inspired, breathe, perspire, despite how I aspire to speak as if you cared about words I juggle like my magic makes you a real beauty so I may be bloom, matter after April, be June, see you lie, August, splash puddles, beached, imagine, you, just for silly me, my dry lips, singing my empty name, a bitter, a patter. Okay, you've been listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, right here on WGXC, Hudson Community Radio, coming to you live from beautiful out in a secret location, Columbia County. It is the 15th day of August. And I don't think I'm doing no more shows until September. So, stay tuned to WGXD. Be on the lookout. I got a show coming up at September 10th. All right, thanks. Peace out.